Carlin, and I'm one of the program administrators with the Superfund Research Program, and I will be moderating today's session. We will get started in a few moments. While we're waiting for others to log on, I would like to cover a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to the seminar-specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We will also have included pictures and short bio sketches of the presenters. Please note that the presenters' email addresses are hotlinked on that page in case you have any questions for one of them after today's presentation. So for those of you joining us via the limited number of phone lines, we request that you put your phone on mute for this seminar. We will have allotted time for questions and answers, at which point you are welcome to take your phone off of mute and ask the question. If you do not have a mute button on your phone, we ask that you take a moment right now to hit *6 to place your phone on mute. When we get to the question and answer periods, you can hit the *6 to unmute your phone. This will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. Again, keep us on mute. Do not put us on hold. So by now, all of you should have clicked on the agenda for today, the go-to session icon, and be joined into the Adobe Connect meeting room. You should all see a number of windows or pods within the room, which includes the presentation materials. Slide number one of the presentation should be visible. I will now move on to slide two, our housekeeping slide. Am I? excuse me. Using this webinar tool, Adobe Connect, participants will be able to view the materials in real time as our presenters provide the seminar. You are not required to manually advance through the slides. Instead, you may sit back, relax, and watch the presentation conducted by our presenters. If you have problems viewing the slides or shared content, you may click the full screen button on the upper right-hand corner of the shared slide window to expand the content. To shrink it back down to normal size, simply press the full screen again. If you experience any other technical issues with Adobe Connect, you may be able to download a portion of the items that will be covered and follow along manually. Please note that we cannot confirm that all portions of the seminar will be available in this manner. The majority of our participants will be listening to the presentation audio online through Adobe Connect. Please be sure that the speaker icon appears in bright green. If not, please click it to enable online audio through Adobe Connect. If you have problems with the audio, please check your own PC speakers or headphones. If you are on the phones, you may need to turn off your speakers or the online audio to eliminate duplicate broadcasts. You may submit your questions by using the Q&A pod you see in the lower right-hand corner. You do not need to wait until the Q&A period to submit your questions. In fact, we highly encourage you to submit them in advance of the Q&A session. Please note that questions will only be available to the host. Other participants will not be able to view your questions. And at the appropriate times for the Q&A, the moderator, myself, will have read the questions out loud to be answered by the presenters. Also, if you experience any technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the Q&A pod to alert us to the technical difficulties you're encountering. Please include a telephone number where you can be reached, and we will try to help you troubleshoot your problem. You may also contact our technical support directly at 301-589-5318. Again, that's 301-589-5318. At the end of the presentation, we will walk you through our links to additional resources pages where we have assembled a series of information that is directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with a soundtrack, so in the near future, you should be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. We also recommend to your colleagues, if they would like to listen to the seminar, that they have access then to these soundtracks as well. You will automatically receive an email once the archive is available. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments, and we, as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery of this particular webinar mechanism. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. With that, I think we're ready to kick off this session. Once more, I would like to remind the phone participants to please keep your phones on mute, and again, do not put us on hold. So today's presenters are Meredith Golden and Tricia Chai-On from Columbia University and Peter Salpas from Salpas Consulting. Our first presentation is going to be a joint presentation by the Superfund Research Program researchers Meredith Golden and Tricia Chai-On. To begin with, Meredith Golden, she is a senior research associate in the Science Application Division at the Center for International Earth Science Information Network, which is a part of the Columbia University Earth Institute. She serves as the co-PI for the Columbia Superfund Research Program Research Translation Corps. Ms. Golden received her undergraduate degree from Yale University and a Master's of Science in Economics, Urban and Regional Planning from the London School of Economics and Political Science. She first started working on issues related to exposures and health effects from hazardous waste sites as an environmental and economic analyst with the Conservation Foundation's Toxic Substances Control Program in 1979. While in Washington, D.C., she helped organize and facilitate dialogue groups consisting of stakeholders from private industry, nonprofit environmental groups, and government agencies, which discussed how best to interpret and implement the legislation related to hazardous chemicals. Ms. Golden also participated in several EPA meetings concerning the passage of the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, better known as CERCLA, also known as the Superfund, in December of 1980. So as a co-PI of the Columbia SRP Research Translation Corps, Ms. Golden has focused her attention on best practices for sustained dialogue among the SRP research projects, corps, government agencies, and interested parties. And geospatial data integration and mapping are two of the key tools that she is using towards accomplishing this goal. So now I'm going to turn it over, I apologize. So the next introduction I'm going to provide will be for Tricia Chai-On. She is a geographic information specialist at the Earth Institute Center for International Earth Science Information Network, same as Ms. Golden. Her interests are in cartography and public health. She has worked extensively on gathering data for the NPL Superfund Footprint Mapper. Tricia received her master's in urban spatial analytics from the University of Pennsylvania and bachelor's in psychology with a minor in environmental science from Barnard College. She assisted with the Research Translation Corps project aimed to continue to populate and update the Columbia University Superfund Research Program online mapping service with site-specific data to aid in visualization and analysis of the impacts of Superfund sites on vulnerable populations for improved assessment and remediation of high-priority sites. So, Meredith and Tricia, I would now like to turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Danielle. Good afternoon, everyone. I really appreciate NIEHS for organizing the Risky Learning Series on GIS, and especially Danielle and Justin Crane. In addition, I'd like to thank Jean Balent from EPA's CLUIN for her technical support and for allowing us to use CLUIN for this broadcast. I want to say, looking over the roster of participants, I see that we have a large and diverse audience here today. But what brings us together is our experiences and expertise working on environmental public health issues. Sorry, I was trying to go move this forward. There we go. Sorry about that. First technical issue. Here's a brief overview of what we hope to cover in this presentation. We'll begin with a quick review of the Superfund program, then provide an explanation of why we think geographic information systems can be useful tools for prioritizing and monitoring cleanups at Superfund sites, as well as understanding community concerns. And finally, I will introduce you to the Columbia SRP Online Interactive Mapping Initiative. My colleague Tricia Chayan, our lead geospatial specialist for our mapping project, will then explain the structure and functionality of our NPL Superfund footprint mapper and take you on a step-by-step tour of how to use it. If we have time, I'd also like to introduce a few other key Superfund interactive maps that are available online. As many of you know, there are several online mapping applications developed by EPA and other agencies which include data on Superfund sites for the nation as a whole. These are often designed for specific programs or audiences, sometimes for internal use only, while others are targeted for the general public. To better understand the pluses and minuses of our mapper, it's helpful to consider the alternatives. I'd like to point out that, as far as I know, there isn't one comprehensive compendium of GIS projects for Superfund sites. So if I've missed any key maps that you know about, please let me know. It's my hope that by sharing our data and geospatial technologies together, we can improve the mapping available to address multiple health and environmental concerns at Superfund sites. We look forward to your feedback and hope that our talk will stimulate more discussion and collaboration. So let's get started. I think it's most important to understand the complexity of the Superfund Act and its administration when considering why and how mapping can assist in its implementation. The information I'm relaying here comes directly from EPA. The Superfund program began in 1980 with the passage of CERCLA, as Danielle had mentioned. Congress passed this law in response to citizen concerns and outrage in the 1970s over the discovery of extremely hazardous toxic waste dumps such as Love Canal and Times Beach. Thus, community involvement has been a key to Superfund from the start. CERCLA authorizes EPA and its partners to address abandoned, accidentally spilled, and illegally dumped hazardous waste that pose current or future threats to human health or the environment. Over the past 30 years, Superfund has located and studied tens of thousands of hazardous waste sites, protected people and the environment from the most contaminated sites, and involved states, local communities, and other partners in these cleanups at these sites. Think about it. That's a lot of different types of geospatial data coming from multiple sources over a long period of time. In order to prioritize cleanups at the worst uncontrolled waste sites, EPA established in 1982 the hazard ranking system, which along with state recommendations determine which sites qualify for the national priorities list. During its first year, 406 sites were added to the NPL. So far, a total of nearly 1,700 sites have been listed. With the passage of the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, or SARA, in 1986, Congress also extended the scope of CERCLA, including an increased focus on human health problems posed by hazardous waste sites and encouraging greater citizen participation in cleanup decisions at these sites. Here's a breakdown of the status of the NPL sites. As you can see, there are both non-federal and federal sites on the NPL. However, the table is already out of date. As of December 2nd, one site has been removed from the final NPL list, so there are now 1,312 final NPL sites and 373 deleted NPL sites. Updating the data in the GIS layers is always an issue for mapping applications. So who's responsible for administering and implementing CERCLA and SARA's mandates? EPA's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, OSWER, has the primary responsibility for implementing the Superfund. Within OSWER, the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation is responsible for managing the long-term complex process of cleaning up non-federal Superfund sites. The Federal Facilities Response and Reuse Office interfaces with agencies such as DOE and DOD to oversee the long-term responses for federal Superfund sites. And the Office of Emergency Management is responsible for short-term responses to emergency situations under Superfund. As you can see, within EPA, there are additional offices with important roles in implementing Superfund. Just this week, I learned that EPA's Sustainable and Healthy Communities Research Program, part of its Office of Research and Development, is involved with two exciting mapping initiatives, Enviro Atlas and the Community Focused Exposure and Risk Screening Tool, CFIRST. EnviroAtlas has an interactive map component called EcoHealth Relationship Browser, which can help users understand the implication of planning and policy decisions on the sustainability of ecosystems and their resources. CFIRST is a GIS and resource access web tool to support cumulative human exposure and risk screening assessments and to help build sustainable, healthy communities. The inclusion of Superfund data could enhance the usefulness of both these tools. And as I said, I just found out about them this week because we had seen the notice from this office at EPA regarding the risky learning webinars. So I really emphasize the importance of us all communicating with each other. Other agencies, including ATSDR, NIEHS, and the Army Corps of Engineers, partner with EPA as specified under Superfund. They make major contributions to the programs in terms of research and remediation. As part of its work, ATSDR's Geospatial Research Analysis and Services Program, otherwise known as GRASP, has created a database of polygon shapefiles for Superfund sites. These we have used in our mapper to delineate the footprint of the Superfund sites. As part of the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, the Superfund Research Program was established within the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences to support and coordinate transdisciplinary research that addresses the broad, complex human and environmental health issues surrounding hazardous waste sites. There are currently 18 university SRP centers across the country. Most have both research translation and community engagement cores. The Columbia University SRP received its first center award in 2000. Our scientists investigate the health effects, geochemistry, and remediation of arsenic and manganese with particular focus on groundwater. Our research translation community engagement cores work with government partners, including those at EPA, USGS, ATSDR, NIEHS, and state and local agencies managing drinking water supplies from groundwater. The NPL Superfund Footprint Mapper is a product of these collaborations. Here's an organizational chart of the Columbia University Superfund Research Program. As you can see, there are three biomedical projects, three geoscience projects, and six supporting cores. Tricia and I are part of the Research Translation Corps. We work with the Columbia SRP scientists to facilitate the translation and enhance the usefulness of their research findings and technological advances. We interact with academics, industry, and the general public and government partners who are mostly concerned with the human health impacts of hazardous exposures from arsenic and manganese in drinking water, both in the U.S. and in Bangladesh. Here is also a list of other agencies and stakeholders. In the U.S., in addition to EPA and its immediate Superfund agency partners, there's a long list of these other agencies and stakeholders who are interested in environmental health exposures and impacts related to Superfund sites. Several, such as the Departments of Defense and Energy, along with the USGS and the National Library of Medicine, have developed online mapping tools with Superfund layers to help them carry out their responsibilities. All these agencies utilize data generated by the Superfund program to accomplish their related mission. The key data sources for the Superfund program are CERCLIS, the toxicological profiles, IRIS, and TOXVAX. These provide information about the Superfund sites and the chemicals found there. When setting priorities, determining appropriate remediation, and monitoring cleanup, it's also very useful to have additional information, such as data on local population characteristics, natural and built environments, meteorological events, and critical infrastructures in proximity to Superfund sites. So many sites, so much data, and so many stakeholders. EPA and other federal and state agencies, plus multiple stakeholders, generate a huge amount of diverse data related and relevant to Superfund sites. To effectively utilize the data and achieve the key Superfund goals of prioritizing cleanups, protecting human health, and providing for citizen participation, the visualization of the data through mapping can play an important role. Maps can convey the risks from multiple exposures to vulnerable populations better than numbers in tables. There are many benefits of using GIS tools to understand and analyze complicated environmental issues. Richard mentions a few in this 1999 paper. The key ones include the ability to sort and integrate records from multiple sources, the addition of remotely sensed data, and the easy visualization of interrelated features for prioritizing public health problems. Columbia's NPL Superfund Footprint Mapper has been created to help users visualize and understand the characteristics of vulnerable populations and the related features that might also impact those populations. It's hoped that by using the mapper, researchers, health practitioners, regulators, and community groups may more easily identify and address potentially hazardous exposures and health concerns near specific sites. It provides quick visualization of potential hotspots, easy access to data for NPL sites, plus multiple hazardous exposures and vulnerable populations, and adjustable scales from the national, regional, and local levels, so users can either look at the big picture or zoom in. Our NPL Superfund Footprint Mapper is different, however, from other online mapping tools in that it displays the location of NPL sites, in most cases with polygon shape files, not points. This is a better approach when trying to determine the proximity of potentially exposed populations. It also uses gridded population data rather than administrative census boundaries, thus reducing the risk posed by census blocks of overestimating or misrepresenting populations in proximity to sites. I'd now like to turn the webinar over to my colleague, Tricia Wu-Chayan, who will tell you more about the mapper's content and its functionality.
This is a screen capture of the NPL Superfund Footprint Mapper. You can access the mapper at superfund.season.columbia.edu/sfmapper. The background map is the ESRI topographic base map. On the left in the map contents, you can turn on different layers to look at. We've turned on the state lines, the EPA regions, which are numbered and outlined in teal, the NPL site buffers with a 1 mile radius, the EPA NPL points, and the ATSDR NPL polygons, which are all in purple. On the top menu bar, there are other tools and functions, which we'll demonstrate later. So how does the Superfund Footprint Mapper work? All the layers in the map content were added to an ESRI ArcMap document, and the map document was published. As we mentioned before, our base map is the ESRI topographic base map. The mapper is built on the ESRI Web Application Development Framework, or WebADF. It's a Java-based wizard-driven system for creating map applications. To look at what's near the NPL sites, we created both a 1 and 4 mile buffer for the NPL points and polygons. For the polygons, the buffer distance is measured from the outer limits of the NPL footprint, giving a better picture of possible exposures. This is particularly relevant to irregularly shaped sites, especially those that are elongated. Some of the information you can get from our mapper is the population within 1 and 4 miles of an NPL site. Here we see the outline of a buffer and the gridded population of women of childbearing age 15 to 44 years old. The U.S. Census population was rasterized on a 30 arc second or approximately 1 kilometer grid cell basis, and the number of people within the buffer was aggregated. What separates our mapper from most other mappers is that we use gridded census data, not census block level data. In using the pixel as a unit of analysis to develop our statistics of population within the buffers, we have reduced the overestimation that results from using an entire block. So what does the Superfund Footprint Mapper show? There are many variables that can be viewed on the mapper. You can see the actual polygon footprint for most of the NPL sites, not just the centroid point location. We have 30 socioeconomic characteristics of population within 1 and 4 miles of the NPL sites. When you zoom in, you can see school names, addresses, and student enrollment of public and private secondary schools, as well as colleges and universities. There are brownfield locations, toxic relief, inventory sites, and high priority chemicals at NPL sites. We also have some western fault lines. The mapper has gridded population density and county data for infant mortality rates by race. The percentage of population over the age of 25 without a high school diploma and the University of South Carolina's Social Vulnerability Index. When you zoom in, you can see the extent of other vulnerable resources like watersheds and wetland areas. We also show the extent of American Indian areas, Alaska Native areas, and Hawaiian homelands with their population characteristics. The details on all of these layers can be found in our metadata guide. How to use the Superfund Mapper. To get you oriented with our mapper, we have a quick tour guide. The quick tour link is on the top menu bar. The quick tour guide has detailed information on tools and functions exploring the map and more information like suggested citations and credits. A map without a legend is not very useful, so the legend for each layer is embedded in the map contents. To see the legend, click on the plus sign next to the data layer. When the legend is open, the plus changes to a minus sign, and you can click again to close the legend. As mentioned before, there is metadata for each of the layers in the mapper. Metadata is data about the data. On the top menu bar, there is the metadata guide button. The metadata layer guide has the name of the data layer, the source, the data year, a short description of the data variables, its geographic units, if the layer is scale dependent and changes depending on when you zoom in or out, and links for other documentation. In our mapper, you can zoom into your area of interest using multiple tools. If you're interested in specific EPA regions, you can use the Zoom to EPA Region button on the upper left and choose your region of interest. EPA Region 2 and 10 each have two different bookmarks because they include non-contiguous states. Here we zoom in to Region 6, which includes Arkansas, Louisiana, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas. In the mapper, not only can you visualize the sites, but we can also get some information about our map features. Here we have used the icon for the Identify tool from the toolbar on the upper right and clicked on the purple ATSDR polygon. We can see that at this location we have clicked, there are many layers, for example, wetlands, the NPL site, 1 mile buffer, the ATSDR polygon, and the American Indian, Alaska Native, Hawaiian homeland areas. If you click on any one of these, you will get more information specific to that data layer. You can save your results for the different sites. For example, here we've clicked on the Eleanor G. Hewitt Public School, the orange icon that is within 1 mile of the Ringwood Mines landfill, and we can add those results to the left panel. Once you've created a map that you like, you can print the map and data results that you've saved. In the upper left, there is a print button. You can give your map a title, specify the map size to be small, medium, or large, and choose the map quality, high or low. There's also the option to print the results, the map, or both of them together. Here's a preview of our small map with a title and legend. The population results of the 1 mile buffer of the Ringwood, New Jersey site have also been included in the print results. Note that the small number of women of childbearing age, 87, might trigger more investigation. Do women in this area have high mortality? Or are they migrating out of this area? It's these types of questions which our mapper helps to raise. It's possible to easily add new layers such as data from other sources. For example, we could add links to photos such as residents near the Superfund site. Moving forward, there are many updates we would like to make to the NPL Superfund footprint mapper. A key one that requires more resources than we currently have would be to add 2010 gridded population data. We are hopeful that we can work with ATSDR to create the shape files for about 150 sites now depicted by points. There are also many functionalities that we would like to add, including a site search, query tools, and basic spatial analysis. One fundamental change we hope to accomplish is to migrate the mapper from the Esri WebABDF architecture to Java Application Programming Interface, API. This is because the Esri WebABDF has been phased out and new functionalities and support are available with the JavaScript API.
As Tricia just mentioned, there are a lot of possibilities for moving forward with our mapper. But one, the last possibility that I mentioned on moving forward is integrating it with existing mapping tools. And that's something that I think all of us should seriously consider, what is out there already and whether it's worth reinventing the wheel or trying to incorporate those aspects of Superfund sites that we're interested in into other existing mappers. So to start with, I'd like to present here just briefly some of the other mapping applications for Superfund sites that look at the entire U.S. Notice that we're only considering the maps for the entire U.S. You should note that there are several mapping tools that focus on specific states or individual sites, which we won't be covering. For example, after a talk, you'll be hearing more about an in-depth and comprehensive mapping service developed by DOE for the Oak Ridge site. But here's a list of selected mapping applications along with their URLs so that you can take a closer look, if you wish, after the talk. Sorry about that. Okay, here we go. A quick comparison of existing mapping for the NPL sites. I'll try to show you quickly what the key aspects are of the mapping services listed here, including EnviroMapper, WebMaps, and ToxMap. To do this comparison, we've decided to focus on the Agriculture Street Landfill Superfund site in New Orleans. One of the reasons that we chose this site is because Hurricane Katrina showed us that the risks involved in locating hazardous waste in disaster-prone locations near vulnerable populations cannot be ignored, and that mapping them certainly helps both first responders and those planning ahead. In our search for maps with Superfund sites, we first looked at EPA's My Maps for My Environment. Although My Environment search located two Superfund sites in New Orleans, you can see one of them here denoted by a square. It did not locate, however, the Agriculture Street landfill. So for some reason, that was missing from its database. We were much more successful with EPA's EnviroMapper. With EnviroMapper, the user can map the location of Superfund sites and numerous layers of Environmental Protection Agency data. There's also a direct link to the surplus data. EnviroMapper also has a tab for what's nearby. If you click on the Superfund site on the map, you can choose the variable size buffers to access the numbers associated with several demographic characteristics for population within the buffer. This is a very useful mapping service. However, it differs from our Columbia mapper in that the Superfund site is designated just by a point, and the population figures are derived from census block groups. As we mentioned before, it's likely that the population estimation within the buffer is less accurate than ours, which uses gridded population. EnviroMapper also enables users to determine which schools are within a specific distance from the centroid of the Superfund site. If I recall, you don't see them on the map, but you do get this list of the schools. The list, however, doesn't tell how many students are enrolled in these schools. These are numbers which the Columbia SRP mapper can provide. EPA's EJ View also provides multiple layers of different attributes which are useful in understanding environmental justice issues. However, the site again is designated by a point, in this case symbolized by a square, and the unit for the demographic data varies from block level to only track or county, depending on the variable. Although you can get reports on the number of people with different demographic characteristics at varying distance from the Superfund site. The methodology used is unclear. It's still worth taking a closer look when you have time. I'm including the NPL map search because it provides a straightforward and simple search mechanism to locate NPL sites. This is something that I would like to be able to add to our mapper. It also links then to the key surplus data, which as Tricia shows, we do have links within our mapper from the individual sites. APSDR's health web map looks promising. However, after numerous tries of using different computers and browsers, we couldn't get it to load, not only for the New Orleans site, but for other geographic locations as well. And I should point out, this can be a problem for any mapper. There's so much data involved that sometimes they just freeze. And so having great technical underpinnings and support are really key to making mappers that have not only good user interface, but also are reliable throughout, no matter how many people are using it. ATSDR also offers links to maps via its public health assessments and health consultations. In this case, ATSDR provides the most accurate map I've seen for the Agricultural Street landfill. This was a link. It's not an interactive map, but it would be really great if details such as these, such as they appear on these maps, could be incorporated into other Superfund maps for the entire country. The National Library of Medicine's ToxMap is focused on toxic chemicals and provides TRI and Superfund data, but it also includes some socio-demographic variables for the years 1990 and 2000, as well as health attributes such as cause of death and specific cancer mortalities. It's unfortunate that ToxMap hasn't had a chance to update the health and population data set. And as we also mentioned before, updating the data is crucial to making the map useful and effective, and that's one of the issues that we've come across as well.
Meredith, this is Danielle. We just had a comment come in that perhaps if you could use the arrow to kind of point out what you're talking about.
Okay, so we'll try to do that. We were trying to use the arrow before, and for some reason it was not working with our mouse here.
Okay, okay, just do the best you can then.
Okay, we're almost through too. So
okay,
if it's possible to do that. In the next slide, I don't think you need to see the arrow particularly because it shows that one of the first groups to map the Superfund sites was the nonprofit environmental defense. The scorecard has good links to Superfund data, but the mapping capabilities, because probably they were one of the first, aren't as sophisticated as more recent products. Finally, I just want to show you how our NPL Superfund Footprint Mapper finds the Agriculture Street landfill and what it has to offer. Here we zoomed directly into EPA Region 6, you can see. And then you can see a drawback to our mapper. We can't go directly into the agricultural site. We happen to know where it is, so we zoom in. And in this case, we can see it in proximity to other sites. So still, as Tricia shown you earlier, you can find the site and the map in the proximity of many population and environmental features. Because I do know where this is located, when I zoomed in to the site itself, I was able to see the footprint of the site as well as the location of nearby features. In this slide, there's specific information showing that within a 1 mile radius of the site, there are nearly 7,500 women of childbearing age. There are 349 students at one of the elementary schools nearby, and the student enrollments at the other schools can be identified and counted. There's a lot more information in terms of the ethnicity and the poverty issues related to the site. Finally, in conclusion, there's much we can learn from the mapping potential. There's much we can learn from mapping potential exposures for vulnerable populations in proximity to Superfund sites. there's also much we can learn from the content and functionality of the numerous mapping initiatives that include Superfund data. I believe that we can enhance these efforts by working together, thus staying closer to realizing the goals of the Superfund program to prioritize cleanups, protect human health, and provide for citizen participation. Please let us know your ideas for GIS collaborations. Finally, I would like to acknowledge the support that we have received from NIEHS for this mapping project. In addition to Tricia and myself, we have a team of at season of GIS and IT specialists who were instrumental in creating the mapper and putting it into production. I'd also like to thank those at ATSDR, EPA, and NIEHS who provided data and support, as well as the numerous beta testers. Now, we look forward to your feedback, and thank you very much for your attention.
Well, Meredith and Tricia, thank you very much for a wonderful presentation. You received several questions, but I think before we get started, though, for the next presentation, I would just like to take a few minutes for some audience questions. So let's go to the phone lines first for Meredith and Tricia. So if you'd like to ask a question, please take your phone off of mute by pressing star 6. Please state your name and organization and then ask your question. And after you're finished asking your question, you can remute your phone by pressing star 6. So any questions on the line? Okay. Well, I think we'll take a few of our online questions. And if anybody does have a question on the phone, please just feel free to interrupt. So so the first question comes from Rafael Jerez, and it's that he or she's asking, is this tool available to private parties, for example, consultants or other agencies?
Yes, our Columbia Superfund Footprint Mapper is actually online, and on your screen you can see the URL. And you can go in there. Also, all the data that we've used for this is also available. Some of it directly and from season, and we have that on our website for CDAC, which is listed in the resource page. And other data we have gotten directly from agencies, and we can redirect whoever's interested in how to obtain that data as well. But the mapper itself is available right now, and please use it, and we'd love your feedback.
Great, thank you for that. So the next question comes from Queenie Mungan Davis, and she is asking, do you have a layer with private municipal supply water wells?
No, and actually that's something we are very, very interested in. There are a few, as far as I know, there are a few states that provide that, but not every state. We're trying to, at this point, put information on the mapper that is available across the U.S., but the mapper does have the capability of adding in other data layers that are more specific to regions or states, and that's something we look forward to doing in the future. And if she has any data layers related to that, we would certainly like to know about it and see if we can add it to the mapper.
I have a question on the phone, too.
Oh, please go ahead.
Hi, Meredith. My name is Brian Picard. I'm with the EPA here in RTP, and specifically I work for a group that is working on the Enviro Atlas.
Right.
And my question is in regards to your desire to collaborate or to potentially tie in with other mapping platforms, and really what I'm wondering is your goal to merely have the ability to kind of crosstalk between different mapping platforms, or are you actually trying to jump onto another mapping platform and eventually kind of pass the puck in a way?
Yeah, pass the baton.
Yeah.
That's something that we're still trying to figure out. You know, our funding for this project was somewhat limited. It was a supplemental grant from NIEHS, and they have been very supportive in letting us continue to do some of the work as part of our research translation core within the Superfund research program. But there's very limited funding. So we're at the point where we have to figure out just what can we do. Can we get more resources for one of the key aspects in my mind is updating our population data, or are other groups out there doing things that are very similar that if they take some of our data and our functionalities and incorporate it in theirs, that's fine for us as well. We want to just make sure that this type of information has a user-friendly interface that all different stakeholders can use. Mm-hmm. So we are very open for talking to others like yourself who are involved with even larger efforts and work out which would be the best way to proceed.
Yeah. We should chat more because this type of data is really what we're looking to bring into the EnviroAtlas, and we have a host of tools that are similar to the ones that you have currently and other ones that I think might provide value. So I'll contact you after the webinar, and we can go from there.
Great. Thank you so much, Ryan.
You bet.
Well, Meredith, it's obvious your presentation really has sparked a lot of questions and interest, but in the sake of time, we're going to have to move on to our next speaker. But thank you again, Meredith and Tricia, for a really, really nice presentation. In Oak Ridge, Tennessee, he received his PhD in geochemistry from Washington University in St. Louis in 1985 and conducted 2 years of postdoc research at the University of Tennessee. He was a professor in the Department of Geology at Auburn University from 1986 through 1993 and was granted tenure in 1992. At Auburn, he taught undergraduate and graduate geology courses, directed graduate student thesis, and conducted research funded by the National Science Foundation and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Dr. Salpas entered the environmental consulting field with Science Applications International Corporation in 1993 and founded Salpas Consulting in 2003. While he was at the Science Applications International Corporation, he was a project manager and lead scientist for Resource Conservation and Recovery Act facility investigations at the Paducah Gaseous Diffusion Plant and Comprehensive Environmental, the CERCLA Act Remedial Investigations, Technology Demonstrations, and Treatability Studies at the Oak Ridge Reservation, East Tennessee Technology Park, and Bear Creek Valley, and at PDDP. From 1999 to 2002, Dr. Salpas was the chief scientist for the Science Applications International Corporation Remedial Action Assessment Contract at PGDP. And in 2002, he began co-developing the dynamic verification strategy for CERCLA soil characterization at the ORR East Tennessee Technology Park and completed that work with Salpas Consulting. Beginning in 2005, he and his DVS co-developer redesigned the DVS into the dynamic characterization strategy for CERCLA soil characterization at the ORR Bethel Valley and Upper East Fork Poplar Creek watersheds. And since 2003, he has co-written three DVS DCS remedial action work plans and associated sample planning documents and written over 40 technical memoranda that describe DVS DCS characterization activities, present analytical data, and evaluate and interpret the data in terms of risk-based evaluation criteria. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Salpas for his presentation.
All right, thank you. Let's see, I have unmuted. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you just fine.
Well, thank you. We are pleased to have the opportunity to participate in this webinar and would like to thank the organizers for extending an invitation to us to make this presentation. I am Peter Salpas, but I would like to acknowledge the other people who are on the team whose work I will describe here, Pat Halsey of DOE, Deidre Tharp, Phil Clark, and Larry Lewis of Restoration Services. Pat and Deidre are here present with me. Okay, to start off, I would like to give you a roadmap of how we will progress through the presentation. The presentation is divided into six sections. first is an introduction to the Oak Ridge Reservation for those of you who are unfamiliar with it. And next, I will give a brief history of the Oak Ridge Environmental Information System, or ORIS as we call it, and talk about some recent changes and reconfigurations that have been made to the two principal parts of ORIS, the database and the Integrated Geographic Information System. This will be followed by a more in-depth description of the reconfigurations of the ORIS database, and then next will be some examples of how ORIS draws on the database reconfigurations. Then I will talk about changes to the Integrated Geographic Information System in the section on geospatial data, and then finally I'll present the conclusions. So let's begin with the Oak Ridge Reservation and talk about its location and history and the complexity of the reservation in terms of addressing it under CERCLA. The boundaries of the Oak Ridge Reservation are shown on this slide. The reservation comprises approximately 33,500 acres in East Tennessee. This land area includes three Department of Energy plants or sites whose histories go back to the World War II Manhattan Project. There is ETTP, the East Tennessee Technology Park, formerly the K-25 gaseous diffusion plant, ORNL, the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, formerly X-10, and the Y-12 National Security Complex, formerly Y-12. The Oak Ridge Reservation was put on CERCLA's National Priorities List in 1989, owing to the presence of radioactive and hazardous contamination resulting from Manhattan Project and subsequent site activities. The Oak Ridge Reservation has been subdivided into watersheds and is being addressed under CERCLA with multiple watershed interim records of decision because of several factors that contribute to the complexity of the reservation. The interim rods establish criteria for source remediation to reduce risk to the industrial worker and to protect groundwater. Each interim rod will be followed by a watershed final rod. This photo is the same as in the previous slide, but with the Oak Ridge Reservation boundaries removed. I want to use this slide to help explain some of the complexities of the reservation. On a grand scale, the Oak Ridge Reservation lies in the Valley and Ridge Geologic Province of the eastern U.S. This province is characterized by northeast, southwest trending ridges and valleys that form during folding and faulting of rocks deposited in a shallow marine environment. The ridges and valleys show up well on this slide because the ridge tops are typically forested in dark green, whereas the valleys show up as a lighter green color. Each of the three DOE plants lies in its own valley or set of valleys, each constituting a separate watershed. So there's the ETTP watershed, and at ORNL, there's the Bethel Valley watershed, and just to the south of it is the Melton Valley watershed. And at Y-12, there's the Upper East Fork Poplar Creek watershed, and to the southwest of that is the Bear Creek Valley watershed. The complexity added by this geologic terrain is that as a result of folding and faulting, the rock layers underlying the Oak Ridge Reservation dip to the southeast, so in this direction, and bedding planes and fractures provide pathways for contaminant migration into the deeper subsurface. Karst formation in the abundant carbonate rocks further enhances contaminant migration. The next complexity is that the three DOE plants have had different missions throughout their histories, resulting in different suites of contaminants at each site. In addition, several population centers are adjacent or close to the Oak Ridge Reservation. The city of Oak Ridge, whose downtown area is shown here on this photo, Knoxville to the southeast and just slightly off of the photograph, Farragut to the south, Oliver Springs to the north, see right up here and then off the photograph. Kingston to the west and off the photograph. And then there are several smaller communities scattered around the reservation that you can see on this photograph. And then finally, adjacent water bodies pose the threat of contamination to waters of the state of Tennessee. Now let's take a look at the history and evolution of ORIS and talk about the history of ORIS, the ORIS spatial query tool, the changing role of ORIS, and some enhancements that have been made to ORIS in response to its changing role. The 1992 Federal Facility Agreement between the Department of Energy, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and the state of Tennessee requires that all environmental characterization data and state environmental permit data be stored in a single database. This database is called the Oak Ridge Environmental Information System, or ORIS. There are currently over 14 million data records stored in ORIS, and the database is integrated with a geographic information system map to provide visual representation of the data. On the bottom of this slide is an example of a data download from ORIS with the field names across the top and 11 records displayed. The example has been cropped considerably. A complete download of all the data stored in ORIS would have 108 fields and, of course, over 14 million records. When downloading data, the user can select the fields to download, and the records that are downloaded depend on how the user queries the database. Whoop. I go forward or backward? When downloading data, the user can select the fields to download, and the records that are downloaded depend on how the user queries the database, as we will see later in the presentation. To begin our look at ORIS, I want to introduce the audience to the ORIS Spatial Query Tool. The Spatial Query Tool is the front-end geographic information tool for accessing data from the ORIS database and for viewing geospatial data. This slide shows the spatial query tool right here, and this is what the user sees when ORIS is accessed. There are two parts to the spatial query tool that I want to focus on. The first is the toolbar across the top. This contains tools for manipulating the spatial query tool and for querying data. For example, there are zoom tools, there's a pan tool, and a print tool. But I want to draw your attention to the two data querying tools, the identify tool and the query tool. The identify tool is used to obtain data about individual sample locations, and the query tool is used to construct queries for extracting data from the ORIS database. Now, second is the GIS map, which displays geospatial data in and around the Oak Ridge Reservation. And on the right is the map layer list, which is used to turn on and off the geospatial data that are displayed on the map. In this slide, we see on the map layer list the default layers that are turned on when the user accesses ORIS. Note that the sample locations layer is turned on, and the blue dots that dominate the GIS map represent the locations of all the samples whose data are in the ORIS database. In preparing for the first watershed final rod, it was recognized that the role of ORIS should be more than a database for simply storing and retrieving data. Instead, ORIS should be a tool that supports the future user's ability to visualize, obtain, and manage data in order to understand the risk-based decisions that have been made under the interim rods and to support decisions that will be made in future final rods, as well as to document compliance with state permits. To those ends, the ORIS database and its GIS map have been reconfigured and revised to support the anticipated needs of the future user. The changes are shown on this slide and are arranged to show that there is overlap between certain fields added to the database and map layers added to the GIS map. The database has been reconfigured with the creation of three new data fields, documents, exposure units, and sample status. And new map layers have been added to the ORIS GIS map, including exposure units, sample status, buildings, media actions, circular decision areas, clean parcels, and groundwater plumes. I will describe each of the new fields and map layers as we go through the presentation. In this section, I will describe the new fields added to the database during the database reconfiguration. First, let's talk about documents. Documents are important to the future user because plans, reports, and other types of documents provide the rationale for decisions that have been made under CERCLA. A field has been added to ORIS, which associates each data record in the database with the documents that reference the data. Document names in ORIS are hot-linked to electronic document files in the DOE Information Center. The second new field in the database is exposure units. Exposure units are defined in three of the interim rods as the areas over which risk to the industrial worker is to be calculated and action, no action decisions are to be made. Thus, the spatial distribution of exposure units is an important concept to the future user's understanding of where decisions have been made and where decisions remain outstanding. During the reconfiguration of ORIS, exposure units were added as a field to the ORIS database so that each data record is associated with the exposure unit in which the data were collected, if applicable. Exposure unit boundaries have also been added as a map layer to the ORIS GIS map. As an example of exposure units, a map showing the exposure units at ETTP is shown on the right-hand side of this slide. Exposure units at ETTP range in size from about 2 acres to up to 70 acres. And the third new field added to the database is sample status. Sample status refers to the status of a sample under one of the interim rods. 4 sample status codes have been added to the database so that each data record is associated with the status. Descriptions of the sample status codes are shown here. The EX code means that the sample has been remediated by excavation. The IP code means that the sample has been remediated in place by an in-situ remedial action. The NAR code means that evaluation of the sample's data has demonstrated that no action is required under one of the interim rods, and the ND code means that no decision has been made under one of the interim rods. Now we are going to look at examples of queries of the new database fields in ORIS using the Query and Identify tools, and we will end this section with an example data download showing the three new data fields. Because of the size of the Oak Ridge Reservation and because the reconfigurations of ORIS are most complete for ETTP, we will use ETTP in the examples that follow. Let's take a look at the query tool before proceeding in order to get a feel for how data are queried using the tool. So this slide shows the spatial query tool, okay, with the query tool selected. In order to query the database, the user has to select one or more database fields to query. In this example, the field querying dialog box has been open over here. and the list of queryable database fields is displayed. Notice that the three new fields, document name, exposure unit, and sample status, are included in the list of queryable fields. The user can select one or more fields to be queried, and after selecting a field, the user clicks on Get Values, and all of the values, and a list of all of the values contained in the selected field in the ORIS database pops up. Then the field and the selected values are added to the query string, and the data are available to be downloaded, as we will see in the next two slides. So here is an actual example of how a query is built. In this slide, we build a query using document name as the example. So as you can see, the query tool is selected, and document name was selected as the field to query. The Get Values button has been clicked, and a list of all the documents in ORIS has popped up. Okay, but only a portion of that list is shown here. And we have selected a document for work performed at ETTP. It's the one with the radio button selected and highlighted in yellow. And in the next slide, we have added it to the query string in the query tool dialog box. But before moving on, note the document names in underlined blue font. These documents are hot linked to the DOE Information Center, and by clicking on any one of these document names, an electronic version of the document will be pulled up that the user may download. The two documents at the top of the list have not yet been hot linked. Okay, so here we see our document of interest. It has been added to the query string. And at this point, if we choose to, we can download all of the data associated with the selected document by clicking on Download Data. We will see an example of a data download showing the three new data fields added to the database later in the presentation. First, the slide also demonstrates the flexibility of the ORIS spatial query tool in presenting geospatial data. So if we collect on Refresh Map after adding the document to the query string, all of the sample locations that are referenced in the selected document become highlighted in yellow on the GIS map as shown here. So even though there is no document layer in the GIS map, the ORIS spatial query tool is flexible enough to provide the same information using the query tool. Now we will focus on this area of ETTP in the next slide and most of the remainder of the slides throughout the presentation. Okay, so here we have used the same querying steps just described, but now we are querying on exposure units. On this slide, we have zoomed into the area of ETTP that we looked at in the previous slide, but in this case, we used the query tool to create a query for one of the exposure units included in the document that we previously queried, and that is ETTP Exposure Unit Z171. With this query, the user can download all of the data for samples collected in that exposure unit. Also, with the exposure unit name added to the query string and clicking on Refresh Map, all of the sample locations in the exposure unit become highlighted in yellow as shown on the slide. And now this slide shows a query on the sample status field. Okay, so we're querying sample status, and we've selected the EX sample status as the value, and it's been added to the query string. Refresh map has been selected, and all of the sample locations at ETTP with the EX sample status are highlighted in yellow. The data for these sample locations can be downloaded by clicking on Download Data. All right, now for an example of obtaining data using the Identify tool. So in this slide, we've zoomed in on ETTP exposure unit Z177, which we looked at previously with the exposure unit query. Purpose here is to show the Identify tool, and in particular, to use the tool to obtain the document associations and sample status of a single sample location. So, using the Identify tool, we have selected a sample location on the GIS map. That is location EU77-107, shown by the red X. And the Identify Results dialog box has popped up. This box contains information on the sample location, including the sample status, which in this case is EX. And you'll recall that EX means that the sample has been excavated during a remedial action. Now, several options presented beneath the sample location name, including the option to download data and the option to download the list of documents that reference this sample location. And we've selected documents, and we see here four documents have popped up, and these four documents are all hot linked to the DOE Information Center, and each of these documents references this sample location that we've selected on the GIS map. All right, as promised, here is an example of a data download showing the three new fields that have been added to the ORIS database: exposure unit, sample status, and document name. This particular data download is for ETTP sample location EU77-107. And we see from the download that the sample location is located in exposure unit Z177, that the location has been remediated by excavation, and that there are four documents that reference the data at this sample location. Notice, too, that there is a sample status comment field included in the download. This field provides a description of the rationale for the sample status. In this case, the sample was excavated in 2004-2005 during a remedial action conducted under an interim ROD. All right, in this section, we are going to look at the new map layers that have been added to the ORIS GIS map. Again, we will focus on ETTP. The presentation of the new map layers has been divided up into several slides. We will begin with descriptions of the new map layers and follow that with examples of the new map layers displayed on the GIS map. So here is a list of the new map layers with their descriptions. The first two new map layers, exposure units and sample status, are also new fields in the database and were described previously. So that leaves us with buildings, and there is a map layer for showing existing buildings, a map layer for showing buildings demolished to their slabs, and a map layer showing areas where both building and slab have been demolished. There's a media actions map layer that shows where environmental media actions, such as remedial actions on soils, have been conducted. and non-environmental media actions, such as removal actions on buildings, have been conducted. The CERCLA decision area map layer displays the areas of the Oak Ridge Reservation addressed by an interim ROD. The clean parcels map layer shows areas of the reservation determined to have never been on the national priority list. And the groundwater plumes map layer shows areas of the reservation underlain by contaminated groundwater. We will begin our look at the new map layers with the two that are also included as new fields in the database, exposure units and sample status. During the reconfiguration of ORIS, exposure units were added as a field to the ORIS database and as a layer on the GIS map. Earlier, when we queried the database for exposure units, we saw that exposure unit sample locations could be displayed on the GIS map. In this slide, ETTP exposure units have been selected from the map layer list, and the map now displays the exposure unit boundaries and the labels. As described previously, ETTP exposure units range in size from 2 acres to up to 70 acres. Now on this slide, we show ETTP on the GIS map again, but with the excavated sample location status map layer turned on. And the excavated sample locations show up as red dots, thereby providing the user a visual representation of where excavations have been conducted across the site. The same can be done for any or all of the sample statuses. All right. Well, to this point, we have seen data displayed on the GIS map for the new fields that have been added to the database. Several other new layers have been added to the GIS map that are not associated with the fields in the database. And so in this slide, we see ETTP on the GIS map again, and the following new fields have been selected on the map layer list. Existing buildings, and they show up as these dark shaded areas. Buildings that have been demolished to slab, they show up as the gray shaded areas. And areas where both buildings and slabs have been demolished showed up as these outlined unfilled areas. The CERCLA decision area map layer has also been turned on. And in this case, the CERCLA decision area is all of ETTP, and it shows up as these two shades of green. The clean parcels map layer has been turned on, and clean parcels show up as these yellow hatchered pattern areas. And the groundwater plumes map layer has been turned on, and the areas that are underlain by contaminated groundwater are shown up with this show up with this brown color. CERCLA media actions is another new map layer that is not displayed here, but which we will look at more closely in the next slide. So here on the GIS map, we have zoomed in on ETTP exposure unit Z177. The map layer list shows that we have selected excavated and in-place environmental media actions. Previously, we saw that excavated and in-place are sample statuses that pertain to individual sample locations. When selected from the map layer list, however, the areas of excavated or in-place remedial actions are displayed. Excavated in pink, excavated in pink, and in place in yellow. Information about environmental media action areas can be obtained using the Identify tool. In this example, we have selected the excavated area with the Identify tool, as shown by the red X, and the Identify results box has popped up, presenting the name of the area in which the action was conducted, in this case, Blair Quarry, the name of the action itself, in this case, Blair Quarry remedial action, the year in which the action was conducted, a brief description of the action, soil excavation, the decision document under which the action was conducted, and in this case, it's one of the interim rods, and then the completion document that describes the action. Notice that both documents are hot linked to the DOE Information Center. Okay, in conclusion, several factors such as geology, site history, and proximity to population centers and water bodies contribute to the complexity of the Oak Ridge Reservation, which has led to multiple watershed interim records of decision to manage risk to the industrial worker and to protect groundwater. Historically, the function of ORIS has been as a data storage and retrieval tool to support the interim rods and to document state permit compliance. But recently, it was recognized that the role of ORIS should be expanded, and the database has been reconfigured and new map layers added to the GIS map to support the future user's ability to understand the risk management decisions that have been made on the reservation and to access the information necessary in order to make future decisions. Information on ORIS and an ORIS user ID and password can be obtained by contacting ORIS at ettp.doe.gov. And that concludes the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Salpas. It sounds like a tremendous amount of work that you put into that. So I'd like to go ahead and take a few minutes for questions, but as we did with the previous two speakers, we're going to go with the phone line first. So if you'd like to ask a question, please take your phone off of mute by pressing star 6. Remember to state your name and your organization and to ask your question. So I'm going to open it to the phone lines now. Okay, Dr. Salpas, it sounds like a quiet bunch, but we have a couple of questions that have come in through our online mechanism. So the first one comes from Fred Veerman, and he's asking, how many documents can be linked to one item of data, and how is the linking accomplished with historical documents and older data?
Well, the number of documents that can be linked is as many documents as there are or that we can find that reference the data. And now the second part of the question, can you repeat that?
Yeah. How is the linking accomplished with historical documents and older data?
The actual process of doing that is it's actually a good question. It's taken a lot of work, but it's, first of all, and I hope I'm getting at the question, but first of all, we look at the data in ORIS, and basically we're able to recognize the older historical data just by the dates. And then being familiar with the Oak Ridge Reservation and work that's been done on the reservation, then we can go back and figure out what documents those data were or have been referenced in. So it's kind of a research project almost, figuring that out. Okay?
Okay. I would assume, Fred, if you're there, if you have any other follow-up questions, to please follow up with Peter. We have also received another question from Ed Maureen, asking what geographic area is ORIS applicable to?
It's the Oak Ridge Reservation.
Exactly. So, I mean, Ed, if you have any other clarifying points that you wanted from that particular question.
So it's the Oak Ridge Reservation whose boundaries I showed, but on the aerial photograph, but Deidre just reminded me, and it's a good point. If you look at the spatial query tool map with the sample locations plotted, there are lots of sample locations that are outside of the reservation, and that's because DOE has gone outside the reservation to try and constrain the boundaries of contamination. So all I can say as far as how far out does it go is if you can get into ORIS, just look at the at the spatial query tool map with the sample location map layer turned on.
Oh, okay. So Ed just also he said thanks, that answers my question. So I think we're good. And then we just received another question from Chuck Maurice. Is there a way to change the plotted colors? So, for example, if you're an individual with color blindness.
Well, I'm going to defer to Deidre on that. She's our database person.
Hi, this is Deidre. You can't interactively change the color, but colors can be changed in the software. In other words, we have a very active ORIS user community, so if they suggest that colors be changed on the polygons or the dots, we consider all those changes, and changes can be made.
Well, thank you very much for answering that question as well. So before we open the question and answer session to all three presenters, and I just want to be sure, Meredith and Tricia, you're both still on the line?
Yes, we're here.
Okay, great. So I just wanted to make sure that everyone is aware of the links page and the online feedback form. So on the links page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you and your colleagues will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. And associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery of these webinars. So links to the additional resources page and the feedback form can be found on the last slide of the presentation. So we do have just a few more announcements before we open up the questions to all the presenters. Mentioned that the third and final webinar in this series will be on December 13th. Registration information is available on the SRP Risky Learning webpage and on the CLUIN webpage. And the third session was originally scheduled for October 7th. However, due to our government shutdown, it was postponed. The second thing I want to mention is stay up to date with the latest SRP news and events by following us on our SRP Twitter feed, which is the @ SRP_NIEHS. So now I'm going to open up the question and answer session to all three presenters. And if you have a question, first we're going to open it to the phone line. So please take your phone off of mute by pressing *6. And state your name and your organization, and then please feel free to ask your question. So anyone on the phone line, please go ahead. Okay, so we'll go back to some of the questions that we received. So beginning with Meredith and Tricia. This question comes in, and I apologize for pronouncing their name incorrectly, but Sutapa Mukopayeha, what is the source of population grid map, and how is it different from census tract population data?
Okay, this is Meredith. At the center where Trish and I work, season, we put a lot of emphasis on providing free and accessible data that we've developed. And one of the things that we've done is we've taken the U.S. Census data, and basically we have disaggregated the block group data into pixels. And we have an algorithm that we use for doing that. And Tricia, do you want to explain that a little bit more? It's more in your... Well, okay. Go ahead.
I mean, you can access this data from the CDAC website. All that information is included in the metadata and the direct link to the website and how to access any of the data that we used in the mapper. It's all publicly available.
So. Yeah, and it is a detailed process, but basically it is an algorithm that we've used to go through all of the census data block by block group and then reallocate it to pixels that are basically a 1 square kilometer size. And for that, we basically use a majority rule, but it's kind of a detailed methodology, and I really would recommend going on our websites. And I think under resources, I have links there to those websites.
Okay.
Is there another specific question related to that he has or she has?
I think you've answered it. Meredith, did you have something else you wanted to say?
No, that's it.
Okay. Then there was another question again for Meredith and for Tricia. This comes in from Casey McLaughlin. How many of the Superfund sites have valid polygons versus just a point?
Casey, that's an excellent question. And we have updated, we have added in Superfund sites since we did the first configuration of the mapper. And actually, Tricia's madly looking for that information. I believe that all but about 150 of the sites have polygon shapes. This is something that we got that data from ATSDR directly on the polygons. And they had done the polygons as part of their public, part of their health assessments at the sites, and they did not do it for every site. And the more recent Superfund sites do not have the polygon data. It's my hope that we can eventually maybe assist ATSDR or encourage them to go back and fill in the information that they need for developing and drawing these polygons for the sites that we don't have for it. Trish is kind of trying to find out specifically, but I believe it's all but about 150 of the sites.
Okay, thank you very much for answering that question. So now I'm going to direct the next two questions to Peter. Peter, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay, so this one comes in from Rob Julo. What is the most challenging aspect of building a scalable system such as ORISE, considering how many records are a part of the project?
Hang on just a minute. We're putting our hands.
Operating.
Go ahead, Deidre.
I get, this is Deidre. One of the challenges we face is keeping the buildings layer updated, because here in Oak Ridge, the Oak Ridge Reservation, a lot of buildings are being torn down, the B&B process. So trying to keep those current and up to date is challenging. Is that the type of question you're asking?
I hope that's what Rob is asking. If that's what Rob, if he's still on the line, that would be good for him to clarify. But I think you did a fine job. And again, for Peter and for Deirdre, could you please answer Michael Gill's question? And actually, I think it's more of a comment. He says, we would love to share ORISE with my DOE counterparts. Are you able to roughly quantify the effort to start up such a project on a similar scale site? Our FFA doesn't currently include digitized data.
Well, this is Deidre, and Pat may want to answer also. I know we have a program called Technology Transfer where you can share software among federal programs and provide assistance as far as estimating like labor hours to create GIS data. I would have to see all the different varieties of data that needs to be converted to geospatial.
The only thing I can, this is Pat, I can only add that a lot of the laboratories that we use here transmit their data to us electronically, and then it's just an automatic feed into it with a little tweaking. But, you know, we seem to get the data in there quite well. Linking it back to the documents is in the previous question has been the challenge, but the administrative record is a good source for us to work from.
Okay. Yeah, and Michael Gill, he followed up with an additional question. He, again, referring to your ORISE, but that the he wants to know about the annual budget to maintain and enhance the system.
We don't have my best estimate right now is for just the ORIS system itself, it's around 300,000. But we've also got a couple of other systems that keep up with the laboratory activities and verification of the data. All in all, it's a pretty significant cost. But the major cost is getting the lab work performed.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Peter. So it's good to keep in mind Pat's comments here that there's a lot of work going on the Oak Ridge Reservation, especially at ETTP. Buildings are coming down. Soils and water are being characterized, and so there's a whole routine of collecting samples, sending the samples to the lab, getting the data back from the lab, getting the data into ORIS. So it can be a pretty large undertaking.
It's difficult to put a price tag on it because the projects themselves individually carry the cost of getting the analytical work performed, and that's done separately from keeping the ORIS system fed and well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for answering all of those questions.
I just wanted to add that Tricia has found the data that Casey was asking for previously, and in our Superfund mapper, we have 1,571 polygons for Superfund sites that were active and deleted, and we have 145 points for those same types of. So as you can see, we have majority are polygons, but we're hoping to get it to at some point to 100%.
Okay. Because Casey followed up with another comment, just says that Superfund polygons is a topic of concern at EPA right now, just FYI. So maybe
And I should mention that, too. I've been in conversation with different people at EPA, including the CIT group, and I hadn't realized that the polygons, how you define the boundaries of Superfund sites, there are different methodologies used for that, and I am not totally clear on how ATSDR defines the boundaries, and I believe EPA is having a discussion right now, a little controversy on which would be the appropriate boundaries, because at this point EPA in their mappers don't use boundary data at all. They only use point data, and part of their concern is which of the boundary data or the polygons would be appropriate.
That's very interesting. Thanks for letting us know about that. I'm going to go back to some questions again for Meredith and Patricia. This one comes from, actually I think it's more of a comment, from Fiona Renton. So instead of using multiple closed map applications, it may be better to provide feeds of data that anyone is able to connect to and integrate with their own data, such as ArcGIS online or other GeoRSS data feeds. Do you have any comment about that?
I'll let our geospatial specialist comment.
That would be nice to have interactive online data that you could add into our system, but our data has been cleaned, and it takes a long process to do that. So there are pros and cons to that.
In fact, it's been cleaned and verified painstakingly. In fact, the data sets that we have gotten on Superfund sites from both EPA and ATSTR, in both cases, they've sometimes had sites located in the middle of the ocean, which are not, it's just sometimes a minus sign goes into the lat long when it's not supposed to. So it's very important to vet the data before we add it into the mapper.
Okay, thank you very much. And then, you know, we've been receiving just sort of these like comments coming in, so I hope that I've captured them enough. But again, this is directed again towards Meredith and Tricia. So I would suggest maybe following up with Chuck Maurice and perhaps Judy Manners. So Judy says here she's not sure that public supply well locations could be made public, and that was, I think, referring to an earlier question about the public supply wells.
Yeah, I think it depends on state regulations. From my experience, that a very few, but some states do permit it. But I think that's one of the issues.
Okay, and then Chuck Maurice wants to know: are there any plans to add ecological ecosystem or other sustainability info onto the Columbia University mapper? And then he says, relatedly, slide 11 doesn't mention protection of human health and the environment.
Actually, there are other ongoing projects at CSUN that deal a lot with ecological realms and systems. And CSUN actually, as in their name, we do a lot of international, worldwide mapping as well. So I don't think it would be too difficult for us to add an ecological level. I can't find my slide 11 right away, but I will look at that and get back to Chuck.
Okay, great. And then I think we had a question here within the room, back to Peter real quick. We just want to be sure, can anybody email that email address that you listed at the very end of your presentation and ask for permission to your site, or do you have to be a federal or an academic person, or are there just any criteria for that?
No, anyone can email that email address, request in an ORIS account. All the data in ORIS have been cleared for public release, all the GIS data and environmental data.
Okay, great. That's terrific. So we just have maybe a few, let's see what we have. We have another one came in here. Okay, I'm not quite sure who this one needs to be directed to. This is from Charles Sullivan, and he is asking, is there a move to link these various databases such that if one scrolls over a site, a block opens up that provides hot links to other databases providing information on that site? In this manner, a user could gain the benefit of all information that exists on particular sites without all the databases being integrated. So I think that's a question for all of our speakers.
I actually think that might be more for Peter, because with our databases, you don't scroll over, but you can take the identifier and click on it, and you do have links to all the information that we have within our mapper that are related to that particular site and to the area around the site.
one of the things that you, one of the pieces of information that you do get when you click on a site is a link back to the web page for the site that shows the full status of the site from its beginning and what stage it is in the process.
Yeah, and this is Peter, and all of our data are contained in a single database. So I don't know how that would work.
Well, with proper funding and resources, sure, you can link to any database, but that can be time-consuming.
That's a good point.
But all we show on ORIS are...
No, ORIS is only pointing to the Oak Ridge Environmental Information Database. It's an Oracle database.
Okay. And so this question is from Michael Gill. This is directed, again, to Peter's group. So is the back-end relational database management system for ORISE Oracle?
Yes, it's Oracle 11G.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. And then I think Charles Sullivan, I think, has a follow-up comment about the question previously I just asked. So the presenters provide different kinds of information. This is a shortcut way to get all of the information available. So I think that's just the final comment from him. Okay. And I think we have time for maybe two more questions is what I have here before we close. So Michael Gill, again, I think this is directed to Meredith and to Tricia. So question about the NPL site boundary definition. How do you define site in a standardized manner? For instance, listing package, current extent of contamination, soil/groundwater.
Hey, Mike. Actually, as I was trying to explain before, we actually just took the polygons for the sites directly from APSDR, and a little bit naively because I hadn't really thought through or realized that there could be different ways to characterize the site footprints. And that's something, if anyone from APSDR happens to be listening, we'd really appreciate their input. I have actually put in a query to Andy Dent, who heads up GRASP, trying to determine just the methodology that they used when they came up with the database for the shapefile polygons for Superfund sites. So unfortunately, I don't know your answer, and I think it's a really, really interesting point. I would even say we could have a conference that just focused on defining that and the different uses of depicting Superfund sites in different ways, because I'm sure some users would want it based on the chemical exposures and for certain chemicals. Others would be interested not only in what it looks like today, but what it looked like 20 years ago, because we know their lag times. People could have been exposed previously to chemicals that no longer are there, but we're still concerned with following up with those people. So, sorry, a short answer is I don't know, but I think it's a really good question, and we need to all think about it and follow up on it.
Okay, and then, Chuck, Maurice had one more follow-up question, and this, again, is to Meredith and to Tricia. So could you repeat the number of polygons one more time for our audience?
Yes, Chuck, within our Superfund mapper, we have, and this includes currently on deleted and proposed Superfund sites, but we were trying to find the date. We haven't updated it at least for a year now, so there'll be more. But we had 1,571 polygons and 145 point data for representing each of the Superfund sites.
Okay, and it sounds to me, going back to what you were talking about previously, our own Jean Belent, she says that she agrees the shape boundaries would make a great topic for a future webinar. So looks like we've got some support. So I just want to be sure, is there anybody on the line that wants to ask a question? Okay, so So I think if there are no more questions at this time, oh, wait, we do, we have, we'll allow one more, and then that's the, and we're going to have to definitely end. So this comes in from Deborah Taylor. What is the form, what format is the downloadable data in, and can it be imported into a spreadsheet or statistical software program?
The data that are downloaded from ORIS come in a text file that can be opened in Excel.
Okay.
And from there, imported or exported to some kind of database access. Okay.
Great. Go ahead.
Okay. Oh, that was it.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you. And Meredith or Tricia, did you want to comment on anything?
No, I found it very interesting listening to ORIS's presentation, and so I really appreciate that. And I think it's spurred some questions in my mind of things we might be able to try doing with our mapper, and I'm hoping others that are responsible for different mapping applications will take this opportunity to add comments to that page and to contact us if they want. I'm hoping that in 2014 we might have a conference which specifically looks at GIS mapping for Superfund sites and get some of the key agency players together to talk in more detail about showcasing their products and also writing a white paper about what's out there so that we can kind of map the future a little bit better. So thank you.
Terrific, terrific. And Peter, did you have any other last-minute closing comments?
No, I don't.
Okay. So if there are no more questions or comments at this time, you can contact the presenters at any time via email with additional questions. Their email addresses are on the seminar homepage on the CLUIN website, which is linked to from the SRP Risky Learning webpage. So if you submit an online question, and in this case we did get to all of them, but they would have been forwarded to the presenters. I would like to thank our presenters once again, Meredith Golden, Tricia Chai-On, and Peter Salpas for their time and patience working through these questions and preparing for wonderful presentations and for sharing those presentations with us today. So this concludes today's webinar. I would also like to just mention that we will have a repeat of our November 12th webinar, which had Dr. Ingrid Padilla and Dr. Allison Sanders, and it will be rescheduled for February 6th. And the title of that presentation was Exposure Assessment in the Field and Links to Human Health. So once again, that concludes today's webinar. Thank you again